On .NET today, we're going to be talking about e-commerce with .NET Core. Yeah, that's a thing. Join me and John to find out about Nopcommerce. Welcome to another show of On.NET. Today, I am with John Baluka,
a
.NET developer, and we're going to be talking about .NET e-commerce with Nopcommerce. Right.
Yes.
Well, thanks for coming today, John.
Oh, thank you. Came all the way from St. Louis.
Well, that's a hell of a trick.
Yes, but it was.
Tell us about Nopcommerce and how did you get involved with that?
Sure. Well, Nopcommerce is a .NET, ASP.NET Core open source solution that is truly free and open source, mm-hmm. unlike a lot of other solutions out there. I got interested in Nopcommerce more as to where I was looking for an enterprise level architecture that was in that Microsoft stack mm-hmm. that I can kind of plug and play technologies with. So I wanted something that I wanted to use for training purposes, mm-hmm. and I didn't want to have to base my work on a Hello World type example.
Right.
I wanted a true enterprise application that's used by millions of people mm-hmm. and be a great test bed to kind of interchange technologies within that tech stack.
Fantastic. It's a weird name. How did you, do you know how?
Nopcommerce, yeah. Yep. It took, I guess if you search enough, you find the answer. But the answer was actually in a blog post. I saw that Andre, the creator of Nopcommerce, kind of responded to someone's question. And he basically responded simply, it's three letters. In other words, I think he was just looking for something that had three letters. And then, of course, the jokes kind of went on from there to where it was not only PayPal, and there's also some really technical term for NOP. I think my favorite is not our problem since it's open source.
So
I think you could his Andre's vision for that was like you can call it whatever you want, and sure. you find a lot of companies based around Nopcommerce using that same little prefix of Nop templates, Nop advanced. So
right.
a lot of companies around Nopcommerce kind of use that three letter in front of their name.
Interesting. So tell us a little bit about it. Like, how do I get started with Nopcommerce if I were to, spin up my own version of it?
Sure. So I prepared a few things. I'm going to jump into that. Then maybe we'll navigate the site and look at GitHub a little and some code.
Perfect.
I'll just kind of fire this up.
Yep.
So yeah, what is Nopcommerce? And I've been giving this presentation around the country to kind of get the word out more about Nopcommerce at various mm-hmm. .NET meetups because it is an architecture that is this, really strong example of what a .NET developer should be looking at
right.
from the front end, business logic and mid-tier, and at the database level.
Okay.
And working with Entity Framework. So, Nopcommerce itself, when it comes to being a shopping cart, it also has features in there of like a blogging platform. It does well when it comes to like SEO engines and things like that. You do multiple stores. So I would think that the features themselves are on par with many other storefronts that you find out there. But it's in the .NET developer stack, which is very appealing to us .NET developers.
Mm-hmm.
When you fire it up, the storefront itself, the example, looks pretty appealing out of the box. It's even responsive, so on a mobile device, if you were to shrink it down, it looks pretty decent.
Yep.
And even on the admin side, where you're managing a lot of different pieces, that's also responsive as well. So I don't know if too many people actually managing products, whatnot, on their mobile device. They might mm-hmm. be, but the site itself on the mobile side is pretty decent even for the admin side.
Very nice. So it has everything. It has the front end to allow you to spin up the platform. It has a comprehensive back end to allow you to manage the platform end
yes.
to end, right?
And fantastic. Then we'll even look at some plugins later on too on how you extend it.
Yeah, because no ecosystem is good if you don't have plugins to
yes.
to work with. Although you can write your own, I suppose, and we'll look into that later on, right?
Right, exactly. We'll touch Excellent. On some examples. So this is the stack, really, what makes up Nopcommerce. Matter of fact, I even have this is a tad outdated because it is a .NET core now,
mm-hmm.
compiling on the 2.2. Uses Entity Framework core. Mm-hmm. It still uses jQuery and the Razor View engine on the front end. So it'll be interesting where Nop goes from here. Are they going to adopt Angular, React, Vue? It's kind of up in the air.
Right.
But of course, that's why it's open source. That's why they have GitHub and mm-hmm. they have forums. For people to kind of share their opinions. I have found that most or many people that really want, let's say, Angular, they're probably doing a custom template anyway.
Right.
So they're just going to use Angular in their custom template if they really want to use that tech stack. So in a way, it's kind of nice that Nopcommerce is kind of generic on the front end.
Yeah, it's not opinionated.
It allows not you opinionated.
To use
like
your
that.
Own technology.
Yes. AutoFact is used for its container. Mm-hmm. And there's also fluent validation. We'll touch on some of these as well throughout the architecture.
So from looking at this, it looks like a very comprehensive kind of a stack and touches all the layers of development from, you know, the front end to the frameworks like AutoFac and AutoMapper, which are, you know, very well established, to the back end, which is a SQL Server, and I suppose you can run it on Azure, or that's yes. The ideal scenario, right?
Yeah, it's actually even a great code base even just to learn more about AutoMapper. Mm-hmm. Fluent Validation, which is another open source library that it uses, Entity Framework and AutoFact. It's yep. A great repository to understand those better. Mm-hmm. So we'll kind of walk through the application front end and the business layer and the data access layer for this.
Sure. Yep.
So the solution itself is actually pretty clean. Mm-hmm. You have your knop.web web is your storefront, mm-hmm. and then you have a common framework there, and your libraries are pretty straightforward. You have some test around the architecture as well, which is great. And then there's plugins that come with the solution
right.
out of the box, which is, it's great that they don't have everything in there. They don't try to have everything in there mm-hmm. because obviously things change a lot.
Yep.
And there is a process on how you would install a plugin and work with that.
Sure.
But they give you enough plugins to kind of get started on the different kinds of plugins that you want to create. So payment type plugins, mm-hmm. shipping plugins. And we'll take a closer look at one or two of these a little later.
Awesome.
So first, I guess we'll kind of come looking at the splash of technologies and kind of maybe keep those in the back of our mind
sure.
as we kind of walk through the architecture itself.
Yep.
So the architecture is pretty clean. I don't want to make it sound like it's this clean. Mm-hmm. So like NOP core, everything points at core. When it comes to NOP.data, it's really referring to just the SQL Server type. The connectivity. Oh,
okay.
So like file access, even Redis is part of this. Mm-hmm. A lot of that code is within NOP.core. So I guess my point on this is that the architecture is probably one of the cleanest architectures I've seen, but it's not like perfect.
Sure.
Everybody's got an opinion.
Yep.
But this one's pretty doggone good.
Excellent.
All right. So I'm going to fly forward through some slides here. Mm-hmm. So we're going to go through NOP Web, NOP Admin a little closer. And the storefront itself, when you fire it up, this is what you would get. However, the first time that you fire it up, NOP mm-hmm. Web, you actually get an installation page of where do you want to put the database.
Right.
So the barrier of entry of working with NOP is pretty easy.
Yes.
In other words, outside of going to the barrier of downloading the source code, and I'll mm-hmm. share some tips on that later, compiling it, running it, what do you do next? You need to know where the data is going to be. It kind of steps you through that process if it cannot find the settings.
Okay.
It'll put the settings in a little bit of an odd location in the earlier versions in this settings file. The reason I highlight this is because anything that seems a little odd about this solution uh-huh. that you may not find in another solution, I try to highlight that.
So I see that is a settings.txt, and I suppose that the SQL Server settings will end up in there?
They are in there, yes. Oh. And they're underneath app data, which is fortunately secured by default on when you do an install.
Still in clean.
There's better ways to do it.
I agree.
I agree, but
a pull request.
I'm surprised how. Yeah, I agree. I agree. But I'm surprised how most of the community is comfortable with how app data itself is secured to a point. Are they focused on the security around app data in
yeah.
this regard?
There's always space for improvement, right?
Yes. So when it comes to finding the connection setting nowadays in 4.0 and up, they put mm-hmm. it in a different location. So
right.
some things kind of move around.
Mm-hmm.
So like if you're going to jump into an architecture, you might think you want to jump into the home page first.
Okay.
So like typically the home page is kind of broken up in these different sections.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a bad place to start. However, you kind of go to the code behind, and it's not really telling you much
right.
about this architecture and what it's doing. So I thought I'd kind of start with a really drop-dead easy page, basic page, the registration page.
Sure.
So kind of looking at this example moving forward, you would kind of look at, okay, the way I look at an MVC architecture is I'll go to the controller first.
Mm-hmm.
And so here we have the register action result. And what we have here is that it's returning the view, which the model is instantiated with inside of it. So the main thing I'm really trying to point out in this example is there's nothing crazy here.
Yep.
It's just your normal MVC architecture, but then you're going to see where there's some aspects of NOP kind of, I guess you'd say, decorated around this.
Mm-hmm.
So one of those, if we look at the model for that last name, we have this NOP resource display name that is really this key value. So out of the box, it's a multilingual. In other words, it handles localization.
Okay.
So it out of the box, you basically have multiple resource files per the language, and the standard throughout the whole application is to use a key rather than putting in some direct text of some
right.
type.
Fantastic.
So it's a really good example of just putting that in your architecture. Mm-hmm. Now, and kind of looking at the same example of this last name, so we kind of highlight just this piece, we see we have some common aspects here like what you would find in the view. Mm-hmm. But here we have this not-required. So what's kind of cool, within the 4.0 version, and or 4.2 now is the current version, but when they went or when they're preparing for ASP.NET Core and using these tag helpers, they implemented it in a pretty neat way. So this is an example of where not-required was implemented as a custom tag helper.
Yep.
And that's tied to this particular key value that we have here. And a way that kind of highlights is, you know, that's what binds it to there. And then down below, to get that little red asterisk on the screen, we mm-hmm. have that little bit of code that puts it there. So I found NOP as just a great reference architecture. And you might see where that this is kind of leading to.
Yeah.
It's a great storefront if you have a need for e-commerce. But if you're just a .NET developer mm-hmm. wanting to learn good architecture, this is a solution to dig into.
Brilliant.
So we'll kind of go on from here to where also on the front end, they use this open source library of Fluent Validation that Jeremy Skinner has created. And the programming style and most of the solution has this Fluent kind of feel about it.
Right.
So, and we'll look at some example code here on the Fluent Validation, how this really works. So by using that particular Fluent Validation dash attributes, we have this attribute around our model, mm-hmm. which we have this Register Validator class that we're going to look at a little bit closer and how it kind of binds those two together. So normally you're putting your validation on your model as attributes throughout. You're
correct.
Going to find that in every Hello World example.
Yep.
This is a little different, meaning that when we look at this validator a little bit closer, we see it's its own class, and that one and that line down here that I have highlighted might be hard to see, but that is the line that's doing the validation and returning the message that the last name is required.
Right.
So it's kind of centralizes it in a way that might be good, might be bad. But what I like the most about this programming pattern that was new to me mm-hmm. is that this register validator class is something that you can inject data into.
Right.
Therefore, it can be testable.
Yes.
That's what's really valuable about, you know, kind of pursuing this pattern a little bit closer.
And I like that it also uses localization as well, so the error message will be in the right language, which is fantastic throughout.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, you even test for that. You can definitely test for those pieces.
Nice.
All right, so then we have the admin piece. And I'm probably going to jump into the business logic here shortly. And actually, the admin is not its own project anymore. It always has been part of the deployment of the storefront. In the 3.9 version earlier, it was its own project. I kind of like left this screenshot in there just to mm-hmm. kind of highlight. It is really is kind of its own kind of code base. I find this to be a really good architecture to look at as a .NET developer because this is the kind of application that most of us are actually programming
yep.
in the real world.
Yep. Line of business applications.
Yeah, so yeah, I found this to be a kind of good place to start for maybe finding some coding patterns for that mm-hmm. purpose. So the navigation is very common here, search. You have the grid here. For the grid itself, they now use data tables, datatables.net.
Mm-hmm.
They actually just switched over to this open source library in version 4.2, the current version this year. Previously, they were using a Kendo UI for a lot of this.
I've worked with both.
Yes.
They have their challenges, you know, depending on what you're doing. Now, going back to the storing of the data, one of the questions that will probably come up or usually should be coming up is how GDPR compliant is NOP?
Great point. So since I was at I didn't expect to talk about this, but since I was there firsthand, mm-hmm. I was at the NOP Commerce Conference in 2017.
Okay.
And an individual was giving a talk on GDPR.
Right.
And the NOP community was there, you know, like Andre and the rest of the people that they make up. They're like, GDPR, we better pay attention. It's amazing how fast they turned and really kind of got that out in the next version to support GDPR and have improved it in every release. So I think they kind of discovered GDPR around the 4.0 version before that was already out.
Okay.
They put in some GDPR aspects in 4.1 mm-hmm. and 4.2, they made it better. So they definitely listen and respond to the community. I saw it firsthand that they take this so serious.
Yep.
Andre and his team that they will listen to you.
Well, it can have some significant implications if you don't implement it right. So mm-hmm. if you're an e-commerce company and you're using an open source framework, you need to make sure that it is, and that's not just for this one, but for our audience as well as they're watching. If you're using any kind of a platform that stores customer data, mm-hmm. you need to be aware about of GDPR and how that can impact, because the yes. fines can be severe,
yes.
as we are learning the last couple of weeks.
And I find that on the, like when it comes to GDPR, mm-hmm. on the like the business features, as well as even the technical features, I find that not commerce is kind of like right where they should be. In yes. other words, they're not bleeding edge on either.
Sure.
They're right there at the edge, but not kind of falling forward. Actually, okay. I have a good example of that.
Sure.
So here we have some, I highlighted certain versions to where like you know, version 1.9 to 2.0, they mm-hmm. actually moved from web forms back in the day to MVC.
Oh, the glorious days of web forms.
So they went Bring through that fun and that change of all that.
Yep.
And then when it comes to prepping for core, I liked how they didn't just cut over to .NET Core.
Sure.
So what they did from version 3.9 to 4.0 is that they put in more of that, you know, the, when it comes to the views, whatnot, and working with tag helpers, they still compiled the framework in 4.0,
right.
but they were able to move a lot of their code base mm-hmm. more .NET Core ready.
Right.
So they didn't make this hard mandate, we got to compile to core.
Yes.
They did what was sensible. And I think this is actually a really good example, just looking at how this company did it and how most companies should probably adopt core.
Yep.
You know, it doesn't have to be that hard.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess
it's a big transition as well. So if you're being interested on .NET, the full framework, mm-hmm. going to .NET Core, there's a big learning curve,
yes.
and there's a lot of work that is required, especially for apps that tend to grow organically.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that's a great example, and if people want to look at how that was done, then I think that's one way to go, right?
Yes.
Cool.
And then 4.0 to 4.1, that's when you could compile to core,
mm-hmm.
and then 4.1 to 4.2. 4.2 was just released in the spring. Now they're advocating even that you can run this on Linux, and it's also it's Docker ready. So when
Perfect.
It comes to having the Docker file and all that in place that you could utilize, it's ready to go. Impressive.
I suppose, considering the size of the website, are they advocating going towards a kind of a microservice architecture or using something like AKS to run the site?
You could, I guess, because the architecture itself, I think if you really want to break it out into like mm-hmm. microservices or something like that, you could.
Okay.
So they're appealing to a lot of different markets. You know,
right.
they're appealing to markets that are, you know, really kind of like WordPress using WooCommerce
mm-hmm.
or even Magento, so where you could have something up and running fast.
Right.
It's not so easy to have a multi-tier architecture with microservices and message
yep.
queues to
mm-hmm.
be up and running fast. But if you really wanted to kind of work with their core libraries and put
right.
your own entry points into those pieces, I think you really could break this up if
right.
you really had to scale.
So right now, it's more or less of a monolith that runs in a container
is.
Rather than running
mm-hmm.
on bare bones or, say, a web app on Azure, right?
Right. But it's... But it's a library that you can pull into multiple entry points.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
So they did it right there. They didn't put everything under. Matter of fact, let's look at some business logic here.
Sounds good.
Because if you're not, let's see, we'll kind of jump in here.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we're gonna look at the NOP services and NOP core a little closer. And just a little bit of a recap, we got the controller that instantiates the model. It also returns the view that has a reference to the model,
mm-hmm.
your normal MVC stuff.
Sure.
And then the controller will get its data from something called a service, a factory, tip, but you can think of it as a service. And that service is gonna populate a domain entity,
mm-hmm.
and then it's gonna fill in the model. So the
right.
separation of concerns in this architecture is pretty strong.
Nice.
So that's, yes, exactly.
And I suspect that AutoMapper is somewhere around here
yes,
where it
comes.
We're
going to show an example of that.
Good.
So a dependency injection and mm-hmm. inversion of control, these are two different topics. I always kind of get introduced to them as like some kind of definition, kind of like this, or
okay.
some kind of boxes and all that.
Sure.
So dependency injection is typically data that you're trying to pass through mm-hmm. a constructor. That's
mm-hmm.
how it's implemented most of the time.
Okay.
And then inversion control is a framework around how things can go very crazy. And I will show an example of how things go very crazy. So when it comes to looking at dependency injection, looking at the customer controller, I could have picked on one of the services, but I picked on the customer controller. Here we have about 30 plus dependencies
yep.
going into that controller. So you can probably think of those as each one of those may be hitting a table, hopefully one or more tables,
mm-hmm.
But they're in order by the appropriate context. The example that we looked at earlier when it came to populating the model,
yep.
That basically came from that first dependency that's passed to prepare the register model.
Gotcha.
So all the data is getting injected correctly.
Okay.
Let me ask you this. Why do we do things like this?
Testability.
Right. Testability, yes. It's a softball question.
I pass.
You pass. So the customer service class, this is an example of one of the classes in the solution where it's kind of mocking out data. But yes, this is the reason why we do this, is why we kind of make it. It wasn't this hard in the 90s, I tell people. But it's done for a good reason. So yes. We can write unit tests and control the data for those tests. So here's where things can go crazy. Mm-hmm. So we're back at the same example. And what if we look at this address model factory?
Right.
For what that has and all of its dependencies, you would think that is a pretty simple class, or it's a pretty simple factory.
I'm not making assumptions because you never know.
So here we go. So we take a closer look at this, and kind of if we were to make a constructor with no parameters, we're in line, I want to instantiate all these classes.
Sure.
I thought I'd see where this would go. So this is not in NopCommerce. So for the address model factory itself, you can see that you got the dependencies of the dependencies that you would have to consider if you were to manually instantiate this. Everywhere where you see red is a database connection.
Yes.
I purposely left that in highlighter red, so you see that.
Wow.
But yes, I typed all of this in while watching some TV show, and there was like 200-300 some odd dependencies of dependencies.
Yes.
When it comes to managing dependency injection.
That's insane. Oh, wow. It's
still going. Yes. This was not fun to do.
Yeah. No.
Of course, I didn't do the rest. I just wanted to get to a full
compile. Oh, wow. That was not the complete list.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a lot. I mean, it's a big application, so there is a lot of services. There are a lot of factories there. I get it, but it goes to show how complicated these kind of applications can be, right?
Right, and that kind of shows why out of the box, you really should think of a container.
Yes.
Fortunately, there's one built in, it's a ASP.NET Core, but AutoFact was, it was carried forward. They might switch over to the built-in one, I'm not sure, but AutoFact was what was available at the time, along with a few other ones to choose from.
Yep.
So as an example, the pattern that's put in place for AutoFact to kind of see what this looks like, they have this pattern to where you have this dependency register class that kind of is used within the architecture itself as well as within your plugins.
Yep.
Because the plugins themselves follow the same architecture as everything else we're looking at today.
Right.
I did a search, I'm sorry, on the dependency register class to kind of show where all that's found throughout the architecture. Mm-hmm. But it's really the AutoFact container builder that's getting passed to this particular registry method. And there's that same instantiation of the address model factory that we had to worry about. Mm-hmm. And it's also interface based. So here we're able to do in one line of code in a safe way versus the ugly way of worrying about how to instantiate that.
Yes, that's absolutely right.
So this hammered it home for me, the value of an IOC container.
And hopefully everyone else out there uses IOC as well, especially for these size of applications, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. All right, so a couple other examples on AutoFact. This one's kind of like by criteria, but I think these are a little bit more standable. By type, you can say anything of this type, go ahead and deal with the instantiation on that. All the controllers up in memory, instantiate them.
Right, yeah.
So that customer controller that we're looking at would have been a good example of how that would have been caught. And more commonly for your data access layer. Now this code might be a little difficult to read, but this is where you find working with containers most often used initially, I guess you would say, when it comes to working with your repositories.
And this one is using NT Framework Core to interact with the database, right?
Yes, it is.
Right, brilliant.
And I will be curious when we look at that if you have seen Entity Framework implemented this way in the past.
Uh-oh.
All right, so first off, I'm going to show this other example of AutoMapper.
Yep.
I know this is a popular library. And where you pretty much object.lastname, whatever that object equals, it just saves you that tedious work.
Correct.
It's an awesome library that's out there. So I kind of you get little things from looking at this code base. So you have these mapping extensions, and there's a reason I had version 3.9 around this, where they even treated AutoMapper almost like a dependency that they wanted to control and contain. So they created these extension methods when it comes to, for example, retrieving the manufacturer and populating the model. So the way this one line of code here is used, it really just calls the one-liner code of AutoMapper.
Yep.
But when you look at how it's used, then you really see, this is kind of nice to where you get the manufacturer and then it populates the domain entity of manufacturer. Mm-hmm. And then here you have the one-liner of two model that populates the model itself. So you got the separation of concerns, but this is a nice way with AutoMapper to fill those in. Now, this was the 3.9 version. Mm-hmm. When I went to look at the 4.2 version recently, I'm like, hey, this changed.
Yep.
And so I was like, okay, they probably changed for a good reason. They probably want more business logic around that filling in from the entity to the model. So this prepare manufacture model, I thought I'd kind of, okay, let's dig deeper into that one.
Sure.
And dig into that a little bit further down, I noticed, well, there's the one-liner now, but now it's using generics.
Mm-hmm.
So in the 4.2 version, they even made it cleaner to work with AutoMapper by passing a generic to it, where you don't have to create these extension methods everywhere.
And I also suspect that this came at the same time that AutoMapper was, because there was a major breaking changes to the latest framework, if I remember correctly. So a lot of things changed around how you call an instance AutoMapper. Yeah, so it definitely looks cleaner.
But
so
it looks it's nice to see how much on top of even working with these other libraries, how much they're on top of making them better and staying current. Yes.
Good.
All right, so we looked at services, the domain entity, and that fills the model. Let's see. Oh, yeah, we didn't look at any logic yet. In other words, this is a logic class where you got a delete customer.
Yep.
And that's just tacking on a dash deleted and updating the records, not really deleting anything.
Mm-hmm.
And
so it's a soft delete, more or less, right?
Exactly, soft delete, like most architectures that you see. And it is passing the customer entity to this to work with. What I like about this is that if you were to look at one of those entities closer, you see that they're pretty dumb. It's just properties and list child properties, I guess you'd say it, or child collections, as you see here. But all the business logic is in the right spot.
Right.
They're not mixing in or you're hiding any other business logic in your domain entities.
Nice.
So it's really clean and even at that minute level. So I'm going to jump to some data access stuff.
Yes.
Now, this is where I'm curious if you've seen Entity Framework implemented like this before. Oops.
And as a reminder, we're looking at the Entity Framework core stuff, right?
Yes, yes. And they really just ported over to core, really.
Okay.
And you could even do a comparison of the different versions, the effort it was there. It wasn't that difficult. It was more so waiting for core to have certain standards in place that framework had.
So. Well, there are some subtle differences, like the many-to-many relationships that are expressed differently on EF Core that there were in the previous versions of EF. So I suspect that there were some changes in the model around that. But
yes, there could have been. But what I liked about the database model itself, for what I was looking for in architecture, the database is a very simple database to follow. Mm-hmm. So just kind of zooming in on how the customers are related to other pieces. It's not overcomplicated in those regards at all.
Yeah, for the size of the application, I mean, it looks fairly simple.
Sometimes you find really crazy structures under the covers.
Or they try to make a
relational database into like an object database and have that kind of craziness going on. I noticed there's a little bit of that here, but very little. But they seem like they have struck the right balance of that.
Yes.
When it comes to really working with a relational database in its best way, and when you kind of have to work with things that are more like entities, like what you probably use with a NoSQL database, they have
which is something
some
I was going
those.
To ask. Like, mm-hmm. if you are a big org that decides to use this one, mm-hmm. how hard would it be to transition to say Cosmos DB from a SQL backend?
Oh.
Not that it doesn't work, but
now you're going to get into my example.
Ooh.
Jumping the gun here, okay. So, yes, they moved from Entity Framework 6 to Entity Framework Core for all this. And the way this architecture is created is that they use the repository pattern.
Yep.
So a service will work with one or more repositories to get its data, and it works with this domain mapper class.
Sure.
And provides this fluent way of tacking on metadata to the domain itself. So it's not duplicating data objects or code, I guess you'd say. But when it comes to the domain mapper class, we're going to look at an example
here. It's probably enriching the data rather than
duplicating. Instead of putting those attributes around your domain entities, those data attributes, they've done it in a way where you use a domain mapper that kind of keeps it in a clean way.
Nice and clean. Mm-hmm. Cool.
Right, we're going to see some of that too. All right, so here's a pretty common example of like get customer ID, where it's really almost like a pass-through of get by ID. And that is, I've seen this in many architectures. We have this interface, I have repository of this type customer, and on the interface has this get by ID.
Yes.
Seen this a lot. So you have this I repository again that has get by ID, insert, update, a lot of your CRUD operations on your domains.
Mm-hmm.
I repository is implemented by EF repository, which is pretty nice. I think it's kind of funny. I think this comment is now gone, but this is in the source code of why they did this way.
Oh, comments. I love comments.
But it's great why it's there. So I think they actually have taken it out, but nonetheless, I thought it's pretty neat that they actually are pretty open of like, this is why we did it this way.
Okay.
All right, so this is where, I'm curious to get your opinion on this too, whether you like this or not. So here you have the table property that's of type iQueryable.
Yep.
Which actually kind of is a pass through here, the entities of iDBSet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we were to go to the customer service class, it's in the business logic.
Right.
Because we have that table property exposed, in theory, we're just projecting this query to Entity Framework, which is then issuing that query. So under the covers, you really, in theory, should be able to change out Entity Framework and put it in, let's say, in Hibernate or Dapper or some other ORM that adheres to the interface. Now, when people see this example, they see, okay, in the business logic, you're doing a query. Mm-hmm. DBAs probably don't like this, or most DBAs I know. But I found it to be not so much that I liked it or didn't like it. I found it to be interesting. I never thought of using Entity Framework in this way in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And it does provide that for quick queries like this, where you're doing a query on a key and you want it by this order, it's probably okay. But if you have something pretty complex, I'm sure you want to do something a different way on pulling back that data. Now, have you seen Entity Framework used this way in the past?
Well, I've seen sometimes Entity Framework getting into business logic layers that shouldn't be there. But at the same time, it's a compromise between efficiency and modularity, right? So sometimes you do it where it's faster and more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, you know, it creates code smells that are not the best. So
yes,
I would say use sparingly and based on a case-by-case scenario. But
so in theory, if your provider adheres to those interfaces, you have the same power.
Yeah.
So I found it to be very interesting. So I've given this talk quite a few times to where I will ask, has anybody seen this before? And I'm so impressed that it's a lot of people that are people that have just come right out of college.
Mm-hmm.
So their professor taught them how to use Entity Framework in this way, which blows me away that they abstracted Entity Framework that far in college.
Well, sometimes too many layers can also cause problems, especially if you're a new developer into a big code base. It becomes like a treasure hunt where you have to find where things get instantiated and actually get called, so you're down the rabbit hole. So I prefer to favor simplicity over complicated stuff, but this is a big solution. So again, having that ability to modularize, say, your backend, it would be fantastic to be able to, you know, not many people do it. They don't go from Entity Framework to, say, Dapper.
Yes.
Just halfway through the project. But I know a couple, like I asked it on Twitter the other day, and some people came back and said, yeah, we actually moved to a different framework because the one that we initially chose was not performing or did not have the capabilities that we're looking for. So having the architecture to support that is fantastic.
Yes, we really could go down the path of changing it out.
And you said that we're going to look into some extensions around, right?
Yeah, so I was going to kind of wrap up on the mapper, just kind of show that example, how this domain mapper works. And yes, I think we can look at some plugins. You have this customer map class, and when it comes to that attribute of like the length of the system name, instead of putting it as an attribute on the model, or the domain entity, it's here in a fluent type syntax that's getting tacked on.
Nice. And it's separation of concerns as well, so you can, you know, update this one without having to update the base class.
Exactly.
Brilliant.
Kind of keep it in the right spot. Okay. And yeah, this is not actually a NopCommerce thing. This is an Entity Framework thing.
Yeah.
So not to confuse what's getting inherited there. And really to wrap up the data side, image files, you can store them in the database file system. The configuration management is pretty rich here.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of things that are out of the box that help prepare for Azure. Also the Redis for a caching solution. I found this architecture pretty cool to look at when it comes to looking at how simple Redis was implemented.
Okay.
probably can't take you directly into code right now, but of that piece of it, but it's a great architecture to look at on how do I implement Redis.
And right.
You'll probably be pleasantly surprised on that. So yes, let's, what I want to kind of point out, one thing I kind of glossed over is that you can just run the application live.
Yep.
You can run the storefront and the administrator. Matter of fact, we kind of fire these up ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
And you can log into the administrator and really just play around, create orders, break stuff. They refresh the database every 15 minutes. You can kind of play around there. And when it comes to GitHub, of course, definitely go out there, check out the source code, and let's look at some code here. So What I want to point out, first off, actually, before we dig into that code itself, when it comes to working with GitHub, mm-hmm. hopefully this is easy to see for everyone else. You can work with GitHub in two different ways. You don't have to use Git. Okay. You can actually use SVN. I know there's not a lot of people that use SVN, and why would they use it? But it is kind of nice how you can actually use the SVN way of doing things if you really want to have those specific versions available. So okay. if you're an AppCommerce developer, you are typically wanting to test against previous versions.
Yes.
And having a structure like this to where SVN, you have these different tags that you could have out there, those source code. I know it's a copy, but mm-hmm. nonetheless, you might want to keep those copies out there for you to work with,
sure.
as well as what's going on in trunk and develop.
Okay.
So I actually work with both.
Okay.
I use SVN, how I connect with GitHub, as well as just I use Git
okay.
as well, and then I work with things in a normal fashion. So really, I kind of want to wrap up here. When it comes to looking at all the plugins that come out of the box,
yep.
don't really want to get into detail on these, but when you kind of get that breadth of what the architecture looks and feels like when it comes to dependency injection and how Entity Framework is implemented, even with that mapper class I showed at the end, you can go to one of the more complicated plugins like this fixed or by country state zip. What that is on the shipping side is a plugin that that you can manually put in place on how you would calculate shipping cost.
Right.
There's also providers for UPS and all of them as well where you mm-hmm. can hit a web service and get that, but this is one that's out of the box. So something like this has a database table involved.
Right.
It has, domain entities. It has views that you're kind of changing out from administering to what you're doing on the UI. So what's most awesome about this architecture is that it just follows that same pattern of the full application, even yep. at the plugin level.
Brilliant.
And the plugins themselves, as a software developer, I think that's where a lot of, developers are kind of attracted to create their own plugins or
yep.
or themes mm-hmm. also. There's definitely a market out there for having different themes
sure.
around AppCommerce. Matter of fact, I would like to show you one example. If we look at the AppCommerce site to get a feel for what's out there on the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, if you kind of scroll through here, matter of
yep.
fact, I think this will even tell us. These put numbers out this side. I believe you got the marketplace here, yes. So you can see what's free or what you can pay for.
Very nice.
But actually what I wanted to show was, it's partner solution. There's a whole bunch of examples out there. mm-hmm. Showcase, there we go. So yes, you can see the 1,120 examples that are out there that are highlighted on their site. They're now at 50,000 active sites
wow.
using AppCommerce.
Okay.
Just a couple of years ago, their number was 30,000.
Growing dramatically, right?
They almost doubled in 2 years
yeah.
on the number of active sites. So yeah, when it comes to AppCommerce, I mean, I think even though it's been around for close to 11 years,
mm-hmm.
As a .NET developer, you didn't miss anything. Now's the
right.
time to kind of dig into this solution. There's other ones out there there's other e-commerce solutions out there that are interesting, but I think this one has that stack for a .NET developer that really is worth digging into.
Well, John, thanks for coming today and telling us all about AppCommerce and e-commerce and .NET Core.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And if you want to learn about AppCommerce as well, then make sure to check the ak.ms/on.net/AppCommerce. Thank you.